Well, good morning. We're in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We'll be looking at the first 14 verses this morning. John will finish the second half of the chapter next week. I would rather preach on, teach on the Song of Solomon than this text this morning. Just not the text I would have ever picked to preach on. But as we go through the book of 1 Corinthians, here we are, and here I am. And so, let's see what happens. Let's read the text, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 1 through 14. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus, our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you. For you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. My defense to those who examine me is this. Do we not have a right to eat and drink? Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working? Who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Or who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? I am not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? Or does not the law also say these things? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. God is not concerned about oxen, is he? Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sake it is written, because the plowman ought to plow in hope, and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. If we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we should reap material things from you? If others share the right over you, do we not more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right because we endure all things that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the fruit of the temple? And those who attend regularly to the altar have their share with the altar? So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. I've entitled the message this morning, A Conflict of Interest. And I mean that in two ways. It's a conflict as I stand here teaching on this subject. You can see from the context of the subject what I'm talking about. It's a conflict of interest because Apostle Paul was doing the same thing as he taught and wrote this letter to the church at Corinth. It's an uncomfortable position for me to be in. I've been in the preaching rotation at this church for 18 or so years. Tomorrow, as mine and Susan's anniversary, we've been married a long time. 35 years. But over half of my married life I have spent in the preaching rotation here at this place. But never one time, I don't think, has this text been taught on. Perhaps some of the principles in this text have been mentioned in other instances and other passages, but I don't think 1 Corinthians 9, verses 1 to 14, have ever been preached in this church. So as we go through this, don't say this is all they want to talk about. All right? It's not. In the text, 14 verses, there are 18 questions. Did you notice the questions? In our study on 1 Peter, one of the things that we did was read through the book of 1 Peter looking for questions that are in the text. And there were in the whole book of 1 Peter, there were four or five questions asked throughout the whole book. And that's about probably par for the rest of the Bible. But here in these 14 verses, there are 18 questions asked. I doubt if you will find 14 consecutive verses anywhere else in the Scriptures that come close to asking that many questions. Why does the author use questions? Let me share with you something about questions. You know this. You may not have thought of it in this sense. But questions, there's a purpose for asking questions. Okay, now I'm going to, y'all see if how well I know my grammar. Let's suppose, for instance, I say, or you say this to me, the sun is shining. Grammatically, that's a statement, right? Y'all correct me if I've got my terms wrong. That's a statement. What happens in my little gray cells when you tell me the sun is shining? Not much. I mean, I contemplate. I understand what you say. It doesn't take me long to understand the four words and know what they mean. And that's the end of it. What if you say, is the sun shining? What happens in my brain? I've got to contemplate something, don't I? I've got to figure out if the sun is shining, because you've asked me now a question. And it's a question that is seeking information. So by asking me the question, you force me to think about it, and I may or may not give you an answer, but to answer the question, at least in my mind. Sun is shining, or yes, it's shining, or no, it's not shining. What if you say it like this? The sun is shining, isn't it? What's different about that? What do we call that? It's a rhetorical question, is the term for it. It's a question that assumes one particular answer. Listen to the question. The sun is shining, isn't it? What answer am I expecting you to give? Yes, it is shining. And sometimes our language doesn't always work that way. Let me give you an example. Suppose at my house we've ate supper and I've just finished a nice warm piece of chocolate pie with a homemade crust. And I go sit in my recliner and kick the leg rest up, and I'm relaxing. Susan's relaxing in the kitchen at the kitchen sink, washing dishes. And Susan makes a statement. Okay, grammatically, this is a statement. The trash needs taken out. Isn't that a statement? No, that's not a statement. That's an imperative. Okay? She's really not trying to tell me that the trash needs taken out. She's demanding that I take the trash out. Right? That's what I hear. I also hear, if you don't do it very soon, it will be thrown out in the yard where the dog can tear it apart, won't it? Rhetorical question that assumes a certain answer, right? The text has 18 questions. I'm pretty sure they are all rhetorical questions. We're going to read the questions. You're going to participate. I'm going to ask the question. I want you to give me the assumed answer. that Paul is expecting? Don't give me the answer you think it ought to be. Give me the answer that you know Paul's expecting. Okay? 18 of them. Let's do them. Am I not free?
Yes.
Okay? Do you know what he means by free? I don't really. I mean, I could give you several possibilities, but I don't have to know what answer he's expecting, do I? He may be talking about free from bondage of sin. I may be free from the law. I may be free as in the fact that I'm not an indentured servant. I may be free the fact that I'm a Roman citizen. I don't really know, but I know what answer he's expecting. Am I not free? Yes. Second question. Am I not an apostle? Yes. Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? Okay, next one is in verse 4. Do we not have a right to eat and drink? Yes. Verse 5, do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the apostles and brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working? No. No, it's not just you and Barnabas, right? Okay. Verse 7. Who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? No one. Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? Okay. Number 8, verse 8. I am not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? No. Or does not the law also say these things? Yes. And he reads the law, or the passage, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. He asks the question, God is not concerned about oxen, is he? No. Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? In case you don't get it, he answers that question for you. Yes, for our sake it was written. Verse 11, if we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much that we should reap material things from you? No. If others share the same right over you, do we not more? Yes. All right, verse 13, do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat of the fruit of the temple? Yes, we know that. Do you not know that those who attend regularly to the altar have their share with the altar? Yes, we know that. Then he concludes, so also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. We could stop. And you'd have a perfect idea of what Paul is saying in this text. He asks the questions, you answer them, you know the questions, you know the answers, you know the point. But let's look at four or five things. They're easily seen, we've just looked at them actually. The first one is an appeal to his apostleship. Paul appeals to four or five things to make his point. His point being, verse 14, the Lord directed that those who proclaim the gospel should make their living from the gospel, or get their living from the gospel. He appeals first to his apostleship. He says, first, I've seen the Lord. When did Paul see the Lord? On the road to Damascus, right? Paul saw the Lord. It was a requirement, it seemed, that the early church gave for someone to be an apostle, that they had to have seen the Lord. And Paul fit that characteristic. Paul also says that you, the church at Corinth, was his work in the Lord. In other words, Paul was instrumental, probably the most instrumental person in starting that work, starting that church at Corinth. They were the fruit of his labor. That church was the fruit of his labor. And his third point is that other apostles, Peter and the other apostles, the Lord's brothers, James, was supported in their work in the church, and why should it be that him and Barnabas would not be, was his argument. This first appeal to Paul's apostleship applied to Paul, but it does not apply to the church today. I don't believe myself that there are apostles in the church today, not in the strict sense. Someone says apostles with a capital A. Okay, the word apostle means a sent forth one. In that sense, a missionary could fit that meaning. But as far as one being a capital A apostle, I think that that's an end. There's an end to that. The second appeal is an appeal to common sense. And he uses three things here. The first one being a soldier. He says, do you expect a soldier who is fighting for his country to do so at his own expense? Is he supposed to pay his own way? Does he fight the enemy during the daytime and have a night job to support his family? That is utter nonsense, don't you think? He does work. That's right. Okay, the second thing he uses is a farmer. Do we expect a farmer to have a crop and to farm his crop, and then when it comes time to reap the harvest, to not get some for himself? Now, he might sell it and get the money, which would be the same thing, but would it be wrong for him to eat some of the fruit of his own crop? No. Every spring, I get the itch to plant a garden, a big garden. Too big. By July, it's too big, if I can still see it for the grass. But every spring, I just get this itch when things start getting green, and, you know, I love to see freshly plowed soil, and I want to plant this garden. This year we planted 48 tomato plants. Do you think I planted those plants expecting that I would not get any of them? No. What I envisioned in my mind was Susan putting them up in the freezer. I envision opening the freezer door about this time of the year and looking in the freezer door and there being these Tupperware type containers that are just red with tomatoes frozen in the freezer. I expect to get fruit from my own crop. What if you're a farmer and you have cows and you have calves? Do you not expect, when you want some beef, to butcher your own steers, to get your own meat, provide your own meat? I would think so. That's reasonable, isn't it? Paul appeals to common sense. We do this all the time in every other area of our life. Why not, he says, do we not expect that from those who teach us, from the pastors? So an appeal to common sense. The next one is an appeal to civil and moral law. Now you'll notice, I noticed this morning, I spelled ox wrong. It says the Oz. Got to look at that, I thought, no, that doesn't look right. How do you spell ox? Bad when you misspell a two-letter word. An appeal to civil and moral law. Paul goes to the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, I think it's 25 verse 4, I believe, where in their law it says, do not muzzle the ox when he is threshing or when he's plowing for you, whatever he's doing, when he's threshing and harvesting your wheat. Why is that? What is the principle there? That the ox who you are using to pull your plow, he has a right for you to take care of him, for you to feed him, for you to provide for him, because he's helping you, he's doing his work, your work. And he mentions as an application of that, he says, do you think God is concerned about oxen? Well, the obvious answer that he wants to give was no. Okay, now, that doesn't mean God doesn't care about his creatures. But the point was, this was not written primarily for the oxen. The application is much broader than that. You think God is talking just strictly about oxen? No. He's talking about also the plowman standing behind the oxen. The man holding the plow. He has a reasonable expectation to be taken care of from the crops he is planting or the crops he is harvesting. So Paul appeals to the law, the moral law and the civil law to make his point. He also appeals to, this is probably a bad word, but the one I could think of is Levitical law. I wanted to make a distinction between this type of law and the oxen threshing the field. He talks about the priest. Does the priest that performs his sacred duties in the temple, does he not have a right to eat from the offerings that have been brought? Well, yes, the law, the Levitical law, made provision for that, didn't it? Okay, let's have a little history lesson. How many tribes were there to the nation of Israel? 12. They were named after whose sons? Jacob, right? Jacob had how many sons? 12, right? So are the 12 sons of Jacob the equivalent of the 12 tribes of Israel? No. Ah, got you there. Okay? There are two sons that are not mentioned, that the tribes are not named for. Who are the two sons that have no name in the tribes? Who? Y'all fix to teach me something, I believe. Joseph. Dan? I think it's Dan. Okay, did the Levites have a tribe? There was a tribe of Levi. They didn't have a portion of land. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. The Levites did not have a portion of the land. Okay, and Joseph did not have a portion of the land. Those two sons were replaced in the 12 by what? Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Okay? Here's my point. Why did the tribe of Levi not have land? Because they were the priests came from that tribe, and God said, they're not going to have a portion of the land. How are they going to make do? The other tribes would take care of them. All right, the same idea. They took care of them as far as their provision. They took care of them in their work in the temple and ministering the sacrifices. So Paul appeals to that idea to justify his point. Everybody with me? I about lost myself on that one. Okay, last point, and this is where we're going to kind of hang our hat for a little bit. I've got it labeled here. Things I have learned about myself. Over the years, I'm going to share with you five things that matter to me. Five things I've learned about myself that I have to guard against, that I feel are important principles that I live my life by. I'm not saying perfectly. They may not fit you, but I suspect they do. I might be more carnal minded than you. I might be more immature. I might be more sinful, all these things, than you are, but maybe not. But I want to share these things with you. I've learned about myself, and you see if they make application to you. It's in the area of giving. It's in the area of giving of myself and my resources. First one is this. I'm talking about myself. I need to give till it hurts a little. Where my treasure is, my heart will follow. I need to give till it hurts a little. Where my treasure is, my heart will follow. I had 48 tomato plants this year. My great vision as I planted those tomato plants was to see tomatoes in the freezer. Quart after quart after quart of tomatoes that Susan would put in stew and chili and all this stuff. Do you know that one Sunday morning, she had 3 Walmart sacks of tomatoes to bring them to church to give away? That wasn't in my plan. Tomatoes. Tomatoes. And therefore, a little while, it hurt. Tomatoes. But I know, because I have experienced, that when I give little, it means little to me. But occasionally, I will be presented with an opportunity where there's a need, and I could give $200 or $300 to somebody and help them out. And I know when I do it, I'm going to have to alter some things I was going to do the next week or two. I'm not going to go broke. I'm not going to lose my place. But I'm not going to get to do what I thought I was going to get to do. And when I give, in those instances, my heart follows my gift. Where my treasure is, eventually, my heart will follow. I suspect that's true for all of us. We need to give until it hurts a little. If I were a millionaire giving somebody $5, that'd hurt. It doesn't. The second point. Things I've learned about myself. Most of my giving needs to go to my local church. That may not fit you, fits me. I'll tell you why. Over the course of my life, I have been taught this maybe not explicitly, but it was certainly implied, that when we came to church, the most important thing that happened at church that day was the preaching. That we sung a few songs and took up an offering and did this and that, and then we got to the important part, and that was the preaching. That's just kind of the way I've been taught. Some people go to church because they like the music. Church has a good music ministry, and they like music. They like to participate in it, so that's why they're there. Some people go because there's an elaborate youth group, or they go for this reason or that reason or whatever. I have become persuaded that all of those things may be important. They may all have value, but you cannot list them as one being more important necessarily than the other. Saying that, I would almost add an exception. And that is this. If teaching was the important thing for a Christian, hearing some good preaching, you know what I would do? I'd get me some DVDs, and on Sunday morning, I'd turn them on at home, and I wouldn't have to get out of my pajamas. I could just sit there and listen to some good Bible teaching. I can find you a host of DVD speakers on DVD that'll beat what me or John will do. And if that's the issue, to have some good teaching, let's just stay home and divide up our DVDs. There's more to it than that. If great music was a thing, we could do the same thing. I looking for a song last night and listened to the choir and the orchestra at Preston Wood Baptist Church in Texas. And I thought about moving to Texas. I loved it. They were good. But there's more to it than that. I want to read you a text, and if you want to turn there, you can. It's in Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10. I'm going to start reading verse 19. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 19. Since therefore, brethren, we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he inaugurated for us through the veil, that is, his flesh. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Start paying attention. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. The writer of Hebrews says, don't forsake coming together as the Christian church, as the assembly of God. And what reason does he give to do it? To encourage one another, right? To stimulate one another to love and good deeds. You can't do that with a TV screen. I would almost suggest that the most important thing that happens here on Sunday mornings, that happens here on Tuesday nights in small group, Thursday nights on small group, that happens in informal times of lunch after Sunday on church, is not the preaching, is not the teaching. The most important thing that happens is that we stimulate one another to love and to good works. We praise God together. We are thankful together with you for what God has done for you. We weep together. We share one another's burdens together. We hold one another up. We encourage one another not to throw in the towel, to stay the course. We need that. And we need to use our resources, our money, to ensure that it can happen. Most of my giving needs to go here. Third thing, I need to be cautious about punishing my elders with my giving. I need to be cautious about punishing my elders with my giving. I'm afraid I've done that before. I don't know about here. I don't think I have here, but I have at churches in my past. Here's how that works. The church makes a decision to do a certain thing. I don't agree with it. I strongly don't agree with it. I don't like it. So here's what I say. I'm not giving my money for that. So I start diverting my money to something else. That'll teach them, won't it? It's that kind of spirit that is damning to my Christian walk. And it happens more often than you think. For instance, let me give you just an example. Our church gives $150 a month to Answers in Genesis on a regular monthly basis. Answers in Genesis is a ministry that I like. If I were a multi-millionaire, I would give them millions to build the Ark Encounter that they're wanting to build. It's a cutting-edge ministry. They receive flack and opposition from places that I would be proud to get flack and opposition from. I like it. Let's suppose on the elder board that I want to increase our giving from $150 a month to $300 a month. And John and Ray don't think we can swing that right now, so we don't do it. Well, here's what I do. Instead of giving $150 to the general fund, I designate $150 to Answers in Genesis. What have I done? I've got my way, haven't I? Is that the way that should be done? No, it's not. I need to be cautious about punishing my elders with my giving. The next one. I need to believe that my elders will be led by God in wisely using, and there's an arrow there too, the church's resources. Let me say it again. I need to believe that my elders will be led by God in wisely using the church's resources. Let me show you how that can work. Now, I want to be careful here, and I want you to be careful how you listen. There are several ministries in our church that every month, if you saw the financial statement, you would see designated gifts. Someone designates a gift to the Burma Fund. Someone designates a gift to Answers in Genesis. Someone designates a gift to Feed the Sheep Shop. and on and on and on. I have no problem with that. Absolutely no problem with that. I designate some of my giving as well. In fact, I give to ministries that don't even go through this church. I'm sure a lot of you do the same thing. I'm not opposed to that. But I want you to put yourself in our shoes here. And I'll give you two examples. One is Burma. The Burma ministry of this church is funded almost totally by one person. I say that in years past, the church has put in almost half. But for the most part, the initiative for the Burma ministry was initiated by one person. The bulk of the giving was done by one person. I have no problem with that. That ministry has been a very fruitful ministry for this church and for people in Burma. Extremely effective, extremely fruitful, and I love it, and I hope we can continue with that course. Another area is our benevolence. A great portion of our benevolence fund has been given by designated gifts from a few people. And I would venture to say a third of the families in this church have benefited from this benevolence fund. We would not have had the opportunity to minister to needy people in this body if those few people had not funded that benevolence fund. You may have been helped because someone funded our benevolence fund. But let me take that to an extreme, okay? Suppose that we encouraged you to everyone to designate all of your giving. Not give anything to the general fund, but to designate all of your giving. Okay, the first thing that would do that I don't think would be wise, that it would place the decision-making of the ministries of the church take it out of the hands of those who know it best, the elders. Second thing is this. If we all designate our gifts, how long do you think it would take before someone would designate their offering to the trash pickup? I've noticed a lot of designated gifts to different things. I haven't yet noticed one for the trash pickup. I haven't noticed one for the electric bill. I haven't noticed one for the gas bill. I haven't noticed one to mountaintop water. I haven't noticed one for buying supplies. You following me? I have no problem with designated giving, but we still have electric bill to pay. Trust, to some measure, your elders to be led by God in wisely using the church's resources. And the last one, I need to give proportionately to my ability. I need to give proportionately to my ability. If I make $30,000 a year and I give, say, $3,000 just to make the numbers easy, and suddenly I start making $300,000 a year, if my giving stays at $3,000, something is wrong. Something is wrong. I want to ask you to examine your giving. Our text is talking about giving to those who feed you. And I'm talking about giving to the church, not to me or John, necessarily. But in our church budget, about 40% of our budget, the money that the church takes in, about 40% goes to pay mine and John's salary. We make about $2,600 a month together, about $1,300 a month apiece that we're paid. If this church had one pastor that was considered a full-time pastor, and that's what we were paying him, he would be in the poverty level of income in our nation. Let's suppose that our church was giving, let's say half, just to make it easy to figure. Half of our income that comes in is given to the pastoral staff. Look at your giving. I look at my giving. And I ask this question. If everyone gave to this church like I give to this church, would my pastor's ministry in preparing a message be diminished or enhanced? You are following me, are you? There's a pastor in Texas. I think he's long dead. This was years ago. He was an old guy then. I think he's been dead a number of years. Pastor of a large Baptist church. I'm not going to mention his name because I might not get the story quite right, and I don't want to be misquoted. But this man was a wealthy man, not because he was pastor of a church. He had income from oil wells. He was a wealthy man, pastor of a large Baptist church, and someone in the church paid him a nice salary. It was a big church. Someone asked, supposedly the story goes, the lady that works in the office, why does this church pay him such a salary? He doesn't need the money to begin with. And her reply was, he gives more to this church than the church pays him. And two things come into play there. In fact, I think the board of the church told him once. He asked them, why do you pay me this? And they said, one reason is because we need to see, the church needs to see how you spend your money. And the second thing is, the church needs to give. The church needs to pay its pastors. In that case, he may not have needed the money, but the church needs to pay anyway because there is a principle involved. We do not need to develop this entitlement mentality within the church. I've been in church all of my life, and I can tell you as a teenager, I sensed a spirit in a lot of church members, that the spirit, and I've never sensed it here, so don't take me wrong here. I've never sensed it in this church, but as a teenager, I was in a church where I sensed this mentality that we don't need to pay the preacher too much. And there's a joke among preachers that churches keep them poor to keep them humble. That's a joke among preachers. That's a sad state of affairs on what it says about the church, isn't it? But this mentality of, he doesn't do much. He does something for 30 minutes on Sunday, and in my case an hour, of preaching or teaching. And he might go see Aunt Sue when she's in the hospital, and we pay him to do all this. You need to give. You do. I don't have to take it, but you need to give. Well, that's it. We can do three things. We can take another offering. I could run from the door through that door pretty quick. Or let's just pray that God will enable us and encourage us, compel us to give, not just money, but gives of ourselves in this place. Will you do it? Let's pray. Father, this is not only about money. It's about our lives. God, would you use our friendships together that develop over being together. God, would you use those things to encourage us, to build us up, to embolden us. God, to make us joyful. God, I thank you for these people who for 18 years have helped Susan and me to bear our burdens. God, I thank you that for 18 years they have shared in our joys. God, I have been, my heart leaps at times when I see a zeal, God, just to walk with you and to learn the scriptures. God, it causes me to dig. It causes me to get back in them myself. God, so many other things that come into play. God, compel us to invest ourselves right here. Amen.